leopard skin pillbox hat. We startled ourselves by arriving in Zaire on a missionary flight, which had not been our original intention. All regular flights in and out of Kinshasa had been disrupted by an outbreak of vicious bickering between Zaire and its ex-colonial masters, the Belgians, and only a series of nifty moves by Mark, telexing through the night from Godalming, had secured us his back door route into the country via Nairobi. We had come to find rhinoceroses, northern white rhinoceroses, of which there were about 22 left in Zaire and 8 in Czechoslovakia. The ones in Czechoslovakia are not in the wild, of course, and are only there because of the life's work of a fanatical Czech northern white rhinoceros collector earlier in this century. There is also a small number in San Diego Zoo, California. We had decided to go to rhino country by a roundabout route in order to see some other things on the way. The aircraft was a 16-seater, filled by the three of us, Mark, Chris Muir, our BBC sound engineer, and myself, and 13 missionaries. Or at least not 13 actual missionaries, but a mixture of missionaries, mission school teachers, and an elderly American couple who are merely very interested in mission work and wore straw hats from Miami, cameras and vacantly benign expressions, which they bestowed on everyone indiscriminately, whether they wanted them or not. We had spent about 2 hours in the glaring sun creeping sleepily around the dilapidated customs and immigration offices in a remote corner of Nairobi's Wilson Airport, trying to spot which was to be our plane and who were to be our travelling companions. It's hard to identify a missionary from first principles, but there was clearly something odd going on because the only place to sit was a small 3-seater bench shaded from the sun by the overhanging roof. And everybody was so busy giving up their places on it to everybody else that in the end it simply remained empty, and we all stood blinking and wilting in the burgeoning morning heat. After an hour of this, Chris muttered something Scottish under his breath, put down his equipment, lay down on the empty bench and went to sleep until the flight was ready. I wish I'd thought of it. I knew from many remarks he had made that Mark had a particular dislike of missionaries, whom he has encountered in the field many times in Africa and Asia, and he seemed to be particularly tense and taciturn as we made our way out across the hot tarmac and took our tiny, cramped seats. I then became rather tense myself as the plane started to taxi out to the runway, because the pre-flight talk from our pilot included a description of our route, an explanation of the safety features of the aircraft, and also a short prayer. I wasn't disturbed so much by the "O Lord, we thank thee for the blessing of this thy day," but "We commend our lives into thy hands, O Lord," is frankly not the sort of thing you want to hear from a pilot as his hand is reaching for the throttle. We hurtled down the runway with white knuckles, and as we climbed into the air, we passed a big old cigar-fat Dakota, finally coming into land, as if it had been delayed by bad weather over the Great Rift Valley for about 30 years. In contradiction of everything sensible we know about geography and geometry, the sky over Kenya is simply much bigger than it is anywhere else. As you are lifted up into it, the sense of limitless immensity spreading beneath you to infinitely distant horizons overwhelms you with excited dread. The atmosphere on board the plane, on the other hand, was so claustrophobically nice it made you want to spit. Everyone was nice. Everyone smiled. Everyone laughed that terribly benign, fading away kind of laugh which sets your teeth on edge. And everyone, strangely enough, wore glasses. And not merely glasses. They nearly all had the same sort of glasses, with rims that were black at the top and transparent at the bottom, such as only English vicars, chemistry teachers and, well, missionaries wear. We sat and behaved ourselves. I find it very hard not to hum tunelessly when I'm trying to behave myself. And this caused, I think, a certain amount of annoyance in the missionary sitting next to me, which he signalled by doing that terribly benign, fading away kind of laugh at me, till I wanted to bite him. I certainly don't like the idea of missionaries. In fact, the whole business fills me with fear and alarm. I don't believe in God, or at least not in the one we've invented for ourselves in England to fulfil our peculiarly English needs, and certainly not in the ones they've invented in America, who supply their servants with toupees, television stations, and, most importantly, toll-free telephone numbers. I wish that people who did believe in such things would keep them to themselves and not export them to the developing world. I sat watching the Miami hats as they gazed out of the window at Africa, between an immensity of land and an immensity of sky, they sat there, incomprehensible, smiling at a continent. I think Conrad said something similar about a boat. They smiled at Mount Kenya, beamed at Mount Kilimanjaro, and were winsomely benign at the whole of the great Rift Valley as it slid majestically past beneath us. They were even terribly pleased and happy about coming into land for a brief stop at Mwanza, Tanzania, which is more, as it turned out, than we were. The aircraft trundled to a halt outside a sort of bus shelter which served Mwanza as an airport, and we were told we had to disembark for half an hour and go and sit in the International Transit Lounge. This consisted of a large concrete shed with two fair-sized rooms in it, connected by a corridor. The building had a kind of bombed appearance to it. Some of the walls were badly crushed and had tangles of rusty iron spilling from their innards and through the elderly travel posters of Italy pasted over them. We moved in for half an hour, hefted our bags of camera equipment to the floor, and slumped over the battered plastic seats. I dug out a cigarette, and Mark dug out his Nikon F3 and MD4 motor drive to photograph me smoking it. There was little else to do. After a moment or two, a man in brown crimpline looked in at us, did not at all like the look of us, and asked us if we were transit passengers. We said we were. He shook his head with infinite weariness and told us that if we were transit passengers, then we were supposed to be in the other of the two rooms. We were obviously very crazy and stupid not to have realized this. He stayed there, slumped against the door jamb, raising his eyebrows pointedly at us until we eventually gathered our gear together and dragged it off down the corridor to the other room. He watched us go past him, shaking his head in wonder and sorrow at the stupid futility of the human condition in general, and ours in particular, and then closed the door behind us. The second room was identical to the first, identical in all respects other than one, which was that it had a hatchway let into one wall. A large, vacant-looking girl was leaning through it, with her elbows on the counter and her fists jammed up into her cheekbones. She was watching some flies crawling up the wall, not with any great interest, because they were not doing anything unexpected, but at least they were doing something. Behind her was a table stacked with biscuits, chocolate bars, cola, and a pot of coffee, and we headed straight towards us like a pack of stoats. Just before we reached it, however, we were suddenly headed off by a man in blue crimpline, who asked us what we thought we were doing in there. We explained that we were transit passengers on our way to Zaire, and he looked at us as if we had completely taken leave of our senses. "Transit passengers," he said. "It is not allowed for transit passengers to be in here." He waved us magnificently away from the snack counter, made us pick up all our gear again, and herded us back through the door and away into the first room, where, a minute later, the man in the brown crimpline found us again. He looked at us. Slow incomprehension engulfed him, followed by sadness, anger, deep frustration, and a sense that the world had been created specifically to cause him vexation. He leant back against the wall, frowned, closed his eyes, and pinched the bridge of his nose. "You are in the wrong room," he said simply. "You are transit passengers. Please go to the other room." There is a wonderful calm that comes over you in such situations, particularly when there is a refreshment kiosk involved. We nodded, picked up our gear in a zen-like manner, and made our way back down the corridor to the second room. Here the man in blue crimpline accosted us once more, but we patiently explained to him that he could fuck off. We needed chocolate, we needed coffee, maybe even a reviving packet of biscuits, and what was more, we intended to have them. We outfaced him, dumped our bags on the ground, walked firmly up to the counter, and hit a major unforeseen snag. The girl wouldn't sell us anything. She seemed surprised that we even bothered to raise the subject. With her fists still jammed into her cheekbones, she shook her head slowly at us and continued to watch the flies on the wall. The problem, it gradually transpired after a conversation which flowed like gum from a tree, was this. She would only accept Tanzanian currency. She knew, without needing to ask, that we didn't have any, for the simple reason that no one ever did. This was an international transit lounge, and the airport had no currency exchange facilities. Therefore, no one who came in here could possibly have any Tanzanian currency, and therefore she couldn't serve them. After a few minutes of futile argument, we had to accept the flawless simplicity of her argument, and just sit out our time there, gloomily eyeing the coffee and chocolate bars, while our pockets bulged with useless dollars, sterling, French francs, and Kenyan shillings. The girl stared vacantly at the flies, obviously resigned to the fact that she never did any business at all. After a while, we became quite interested in watching the flies as well. At last we were told that our flight was ready to depart again, and we returned to our plane load of missionaries. Where, we wondered, had they been while all this had been going on? We didn't ask. After an hour or so, we landed at last at Bukavu, and as we taxied up to the terminal shacks of the airport, the plane resounded to happy cries of, "Oh, how wonderful, the bishop's come to meet us!" And here he was, big and beaming in his purple tunic, wearing glasses with frames that were black at the top and transparent at the bottom. The missionaries, the mission school teachers, and the American couple who were merely very interested in missionary work climbed smiling out of the plane, and we, pausing to pull our camera bags out from under our seats, followed them. We were in Zaire. I think the best way of explaining what goes so hideously wrong with Zaire is to reproduce a card we were given by a tourist officer a few days later. One section of it was written in English and is for the benefit of the tourist. It goes like this. "Madam, Sir, on behalf of the President Founder of the MPR, President of the Republic, of his government, and of my fellow citizens, it is agreeable for me to wish you a wonderful sojourn in the Republic of Zaire. In this country you will discover majestic sights, a luxuriant flora, and an exceptional fauna. The kindness and hospitality of the Zairean people will facilitate your knowledge of the tradition and folklore. Our young nation expects much from your suggestions, and thanks you for your contribution in helping it to welcome the friends you will send us in a much better way. Minister of the ECNT." That seems fair enough. It's the other section which makes you begin to worry a bit about what you might in fact find. You are meant to show it to any Zairewa you actually meet, and it goes like this. "Zairians, help our visitors. The friend holding this card is visiting our country. He is our guest. If he wants to take photographs, be polite and friendly to him. Do your best to have him enjoy his sojourn, and he will come back, bringing his friends with him. By helping him, you help your country. Never forget that tourism provides us with returns which allow us to create new jobs, to build schools, hospitals, factories, etc. On the welcome that our guest would have received will depend our touristic future." It's alarming enough that an exhortation like this should be thought to be necessary, but what is even more worrying is that this section is written only in English. No Zairean, or Zairewa as they actually call themselves, speaks English, or hardly any do. The system by which Zaire works, and which this card was a wonderfully hopeless attempt to correct, is very simple. Every official you encounter will make life as unpleasant for you as he possibly can until you pay him to stop it, in US dollars. He then passes you on to the next official, who will be unpleasant to you all over again. By the end of our trip, this process would assume nightmarish proportions, by comparison with which our first entry into Zaire was a relatively gentle softening up process, and only consisted of 2 hours of rain and misery in huts. The first thing we saw in the customs hut was a picture which gave us a clue about how our expedition to find endangered wildlife in Zaire was going to go. It was a portrait of a leopard. That is, it was a portrait of part of a leopard. The part of the leopard in question had been fashioned into a rather natty leopard-skin pillbox hat, which adorned the head of Marshal Mobutu Sese Seko Kuku Ngbendu Waza Banga, the President of the Republic of Zaire, who gazed down on us with a magisterial calm while his officials got to work on us. One was a large and fairly friendly man who occasionally offered us cigarettes, and the other was a small, nasty man who kept on stealing ours. This is, of course, the classic interrogation method, designed to bring the victim to the brink of pathetic emotional breakdown. It's obviously a technique they learnt somewhere and have just found the habit hard to break, even though all they actually wanted to know from us was our names, passport numbers, and the serial numbers of every single piece of equipment we had with us. The big man in particular seemed to wish us no personal ill, as he guided us gently through the insanity to which it was his duty to subject us, and I came to recognise a feeling I've heard described when oddly close and touching relationships develop between torturers and their victims, or kidnappers and their hostages. There is a feeling of all being in this together. The forms we had to fill in were headed Belgian Congo, crossed out with Zaire written in pencil, which meant they had to be at least 18 years old. The only form they didn't seem to have was the only one we actually wanted. We had been warned by friends that we had to get ourselves a currency declaration form when we entered Zaire, or we would hit trouble later on. We repeatedly asked for one, but they said they had run out. They said we could get one in Goma, and that would be all right. They toyed with the idea of confiscating my Cambridge Z88 laptop computer, just in case we were planning to overthrow the government with it. But in the end, the small nasty man merely confiscated Chris's car magazine on the grounds that he liked cars. And then, for now, we were free. We went into the town of Bukavu in a sort of taxi-like thing. The town turned out to be an enormous distance from the airport, probably at the insistence of the taxi drivers. As we bounded along the appallingly rutted road that followed the margin of the lake, and along which a significant proportion of the population of Zaire seemed to be walking, our driver kept on diving beneath the dashboard of the car for long periods at a time. I watched this with some alarm, which was severely increased when I eventually worked out what it was he was doing. He was operating the clutch by hand. I wondered whether to mention this to the others, but decided that no, it would only worry them. Mark later mentioned that we had not passed any other motor vehicles at all on the drive, except for a couple of trucks, which had been parked for so long that they no longer had rear axles. I didn't notice this myself, because once I had identified what the driver was doing with the clutch, I simply kept my eyes closed for the remainder of the journey. When at last we arrived at the hotel, which was surprisingly airy and spacious for such a dilapidated town as Bukavu was, we were rattled and exhausted and started to yawn at each other a lot. This was a kind of unspoken code for being fed up with the sight of one another, despite the fact that it was only 6 in the evening. We each went off to our respective rooms and sat in our separate heaps. I sat by the window and watched as the sun began to go down over the lake, the name of which I couldn't remember because all the maps were in Mark's room. From this vantage point, Bukavu looked quite idyllic, situated on a peninsula which jutted into the lake. Lake Kivu, I remembered the name now. I was still feeling very jangled and jittery and decided that staring at the lake a bit might help. It was placid and silvery, shading to grey in the distance, where it met the fading shapes of the hills that surrounded it. That helped. The early evening light cast long shadows over the old Belgian colonial houses that were stepped down the hill from the hotel, huddled about with bright blossoms and palm trees. That was good, too. Even the green corrugated roofs of the cruder new buildings were soothed by the light. I watched the black kites wheeling out over the water and found that I was calming down. I got up and I started to unpack the things I needed for the night, and at last a wonderful sense of peace and well-being settled on me, disturbed only by the sudden realization that I'd once again left my toothpaste in last night's hotel, and my writing paper, and my cigarette lighter. I decided it was time to explore the town. The main street was a grim hill, wide, dishevelled, and strewn with rubbish. The shops were, for the most part, concrete and dingy, and because Zaire is an ex-Belgian colony, every other shop is a pharmacy, just like in Belgium and France, except that none of them, as it happened, sold toothpaste, which bewildered me. Most of the other shops were, in fact, impossible to identify. When a shop appeared to sell a mixture of ghetto blasters, socks, soap and chickens, it didn't seem unreasonable to go in and ask if they had any toothpaste or paper stuck away on one of their shelves as well. But they looked at me as if I was completely mad. Couldn't I see that this was a ghetto blaster, socks, soap and chicken shop? Eventually, after trailing up and down the street for half a mile in either direction, I found both of them at a tiny street store, which also turned out to sell ball pens, airmail envelopes and cigarette lighters, and in fact seemed to be so peculiarly attuned to my needs that I was tempted to ask if they had a copy of New Scientist as well. I then realised that most of the essentials of life were available out on the street. Photocopying, for example. Here and there along the street were rickety trestle tables with big old photocopiers on them, and I had once or twice been hailed by a street hustler and asked if I wanted to have something photocopied or sleep with his sister. I returned to the hotel, wrote some notes on the writing paper, which for some reason was pink, and slept as if I was dead. The following morning, we flew to the town of Goma. Here we discovered that even when making internal flights in Zaire, you still had to go through the full rigmarole of immigration and customs controls all over again. We were held under armed guard while a large and thuggish airport official interrogated us in his office as to why we hadn't acquired any currency declaration forms at Bukavu. The fact that they hadn't had any currency declaration forms to give us at Bukavu cut no ice with him. $50, he said. His office was large and bare and contained just one small desk with two sheets of paper in a drawer. He leant back and stared at the ceiling, which had obviously seen a lot of this sort of thing going on. Then he leant forward again and pulled the palms of his hands slowly down over his face as if he was trying to peel it off. He said again, $50 each, and then stared idly at the corner of his desk and rolled a pencil slowly in his fingers. We were subjected to an hour of this before he finally tired of our appalling French and let us go. We emerged blinking from the airport and miraculously met up with the driver that some friends of Mark's had organized to take us up into the Virunga volcanoes, where the northern mountain gorillas lived. The gorillas were not the animals we'd come to Zaire to look for. It is very hard, however, to come all the way to Zaire and not to go and see them. I was going to say that this is because they are our closest living relatives, but I'm not sure that's an appropriate reason. Generally, in my experience, when you visit a country in which you have any relatives living, there's a tendency to want to lie low and hope they don't find out you're in town. At least with the gorillas, you know that there's no danger of having to go out to dinner with them and catch up on several million years of family history, so you can visit them with impunity. They are, of course, only collateral relatives, nth cousins n times removed. We are both descended from a common ancestor who is sadly no longer with us, and who has, since Darwin's day, been the subject of endless speculation as to what manner of creature he or she was. The section of the primate family of which we are members, rich, successful members of the family, the ones who made good and who should, by any standards, be looking after the other, less well-off members of the family, are the great apes. We do not actually call ourselves great apes, though. Like many of the immigrants at Ellis Island, we have changed our names. The family we call the great apes includes the gorillas, of which there are three subspecies, mountain, eastern lowland, and western lowland, two species of chimpanzee, and the orangutans of Borneo and Sumatra. We do not like to include ourselves in it. In fact, the classification great apes was originally created specifically to drive a wedge between us and them, and yet it is now widely accepted that the gorillas and chimpanzees separated from us on the evolutionary tree more recently than they did from other great apes. This would mean that the gorillas are more closely related to us than they are to the orangutans. Any classification which includes gorillas and orangutans must therefore include us as well. One way or another, we and the gorillas are very, very close relatives indeed, almost as close to each other as the Indian elephant and the African elephant, which also share a common extinct ancestor. The Virunga volcanoes, where the mountain gorillas live, straddle the border of Zaire, Rwanda, and Uganda. There are about 280 gorillas there, roughly two-thirds of which live in Zaire and the other third in Rwanda. I say roughly because the gorillas are not yet sufficiently advanced in evolutionary terms to have discovered the benefits of passports, currency declaration forms, and official bribery, and therefore tend to wander backwards and forwards across the border as and when their beastly, primitive whim takes them. A few stragglers even pop over into Uganda from time to time, but there are no gorillas actually living there as permanent residents because the Ugandan part of the Virungas only covers about 25 square kilometres, is unprotected and full of people, whom the gorillas, given the choice, would rather steer clear of. The drive from Goma takes about 5 hours, and we made the hastiest departure we could manage after 2.5 hours of serious madness with a ticket agent, a hotel manager, a lunch break, and one of the larger national banks, which it would be tedious to relate, but not half as tedious as it was to undergo. Things hit a limit, though, when I was set upon by a pickpocket in a baker's shop. I didn't notice that I was being set upon by a pickpocket, which I'm glad of, because I like to work only with professionals. Everybody else in the shop did notice, however, and the man was hurriedly manhandled away and ejected into the street, while I was still busy choosing buns. The baker tried to tell me what had happened, but my Zaire-wa French wasn't up to it, and I thought he was merely recommending the currenty ones, of which I therefore bought 6. Mark arrived at that moment with some tinned pears, our gorilla permits, and our driver, who quickly understood what was going on and explained to me what had happened. He also explained that the current buns were no good, but said we may as well keep them because none of the others were any good either, and we had to have something. He was a tall, rangy Muslim with an engaging smile, and he responded very positively to the suggestion that we should now get the hell out of here. When people talk of darkest Africa, it's usually Zaire they have in mind. This is the land of jungles, mountains, enormous rivers, volcanoes, more exotic wildlife than you'd be wise to shake a stick at, hunter-gatherer pygmies who are still largely untouched by Western civilization, and one of the worst transport systems anywhere in the world. This is the Africa in which Stanley presumed to meet Dr. Livingstone. Until the 19th century, this enormous tract of Africa was simply a large black hole in the centre of any European map of the Dark Continent. But it was only after Livingstone's penetration of the interior that the black hole began to exercise any gravitational effect on the outside world. The first people to pour in were the missionaries, Catholics who arrived to teach the native populace that the Protestants were wrong, and Protestants who came to teach that the Catholics were wrong. The only thing the Protestants and Catholics agreed about was that the natives had been wrong for 2,000 years. These were closely followed by traders in search of slaves, ivory, copper, and suitable land on which plantations could be established. With the help of Stanley, who was on a 5-year contract to open up the interior of Africa, King Leopold of the Belgians successfully laid claim to this vast region in 1885. And promptly subjected its inhabitants to an exceptionally brutal and ruthless form of colonization, thus giving them a practical and convincing demonstration of what wrong actually meant. When news of the worst atrocities leaked to the outside world, Leopold was forced to hand over his land to the Belgian government, who took it upon themselves to do virtually nothing about it. But by the 1950s, independence movements were sweeping across Africa, and after riots and appalling massacres in the capital of Kinshasa in 1959, the colonial authorities were shaken so badly that they granted independence the following year. The country eventually changed its name from the Belgian Congo to Zaire in 1971. Zaire, incidentally, is about 80 times the size of Belgium. Like most colonies, Zaire had imposed on it a stifling bureaucracy, the sole function of which was to refer decisions upwards to its colonial masters. Local officials rarely had the power to do things, only to prevent them being done until bribed. So, once the colonial masters are removed, the bureaucracy continues to thrash around like a headless chicken with nothing to do other than trip itself up, bump into things, and, when it can get the firepower, shoot itself in the foot. You can always tell an ex-colony from the inordinate numbers of people who are able to find employment stopping anybody who has anything to do from doing it. 5 hours of sleepy bumping in the van brought us to Bukima, a village in the foothills of the Virungas, which marks the point where the road finally gives up and from which we have to travel on by foot. Set a little way above the village, in front of a large square, was an absurdly grand ex-colonial building, empty, except for an absurdly small office tucked into the back, where a small man in an army uniform pored over our gorilla permits with a grim air of bemusement, as if he'd never seen one before, or at least not for well over an hour. He then occupied himself with a shortwave radio for a few minutes, before turning to us and saying that he knew exactly who we were, had been expecting us, and that because of our contacts with the World Wildlife Fund in Nairobi, he was going to allow us an extra day with the gorillas, and who the hell were we anyway, and why had no one told him we were coming? This seemed on the face of it to be unanswerable, so we left him to try and figure it out for himself, while we went to look for some porters to help us with our baggage for the 3-hour walk up to the warden's hut, where we were to spend the night. They weren't hard to find. There was a large band of them gathered hopefully around our van, and our driver was eager to know how many we needed to carry all our bags. He seemed to emphasize the word all rather strongly. There was a sudden moment of horrible realization. We had been so keen to clear out of Goma as fast as possible that we had forgotten a major part of our plan, which was to leave the bulk of our gear at a hotel in town. As a result of this oversight, we had more baggage with us than we actually needed to carry up to the gorillas. A lot more. As well as basic gorilla watching kit, jeans, t-shirt, a sort of waterproof thing, a ton of cameras and tins of pears, there was also an immense store of dirty laundry, a suit and shoes for meeting my French publisher in Paris, a dozen computer magazines, a thesaurus, half the collected works of Dickens, and a large wooden model of a Komodo dragon. I believe in travelling light, but then I also believe I should give up smoking and shop early for Christmas. Hiding our considerable embarrassment, we chose a team of porters to carry this little lot up into the Virunga volcanoes for us. They didn't mind. If we were prepared to pay them to carry Dickens and aftershave up to the gorillas and back down again, then they were perfectly happy to do it. White men have done much worse things in Zaire than that, but maybe not much sillier. The trek up to the visitors' hut was strenuous and involved plenty of stops for sharing our cigarettes and Coca-Cola with the bearers, while they frequently redistributed the bags of Dickens and computer magazines between themselves and experimented with different and novel methods of keeping them on their heads. For much of the time, we were tramping through wet fields of sago, and a foolish but happy thought suddenly occurred to me. We were walking through the only known anagram of my name, which is Sago Mud Salad. I speculated footlingly as to what possible cosmic significance there could be to this, and by the time I'd finally dismissed the thought, the light was fading and we had arrived at the hut, which was a fairly Spartan wooden building, but new and quite well built. A damp and heavy mist hung over the land, almost obscuring the distant volcano peaks. The evening was unexpectedly cold, and we spent it by the light of hissing tilly lamps, eating our tinned pears and our single remaining bun, and talking in broken French to our two guides, whose names were Morara and Serendori. These were magnificently smooth characters, dressed in military camouflage and black berets, who slouched across the table, languidly caressing their rifles. They explained that the reason for the get-up was that they were ex-commandos. All guides had to carry rifles, they told us, partly as protection against the wildlife, but more importantly, in case they encountered poachers. Morara told us he had personally shot dead 5 poachers. He explained with a shrug that there was pas de problème about it, no bother with inquests or anything like that, he just shot them and went home. He sat back in his chair and idly fingered the rifle sight while we toyed nervously with our pear halves. Poaching of one kind or another is, of course, the single most serious threat to the survival of the mountain gorillas, but it's hard not to wonder whether declaring open season on human beings is the best plan for solving the problem. We are not an endangered species ourselves yet, but this is not for lack of trying. In fact, the poaching problem is declining, or at least parts of it are. 4 in every 5 of the gorillas alive in the world's zoos today were originally taken from the wild, but no public zoo would accept a gorilla now, except from another zoo, since it would be a bit difficult to explain where it came from. However, there is still a demand for them from private collectors, and the unprotected Ugandan part of the Virungas is still a weak link. In September 1988, an infant was captured on the Ugandan side. 2 adult members of its family were shot dead, and the young animal was later sold to Rwandan smugglers by a game warden, now in prison, for about £15,000. This is the most destructive aspect of this sort of poaching. For every young gorilla captured, several other members of its family will probably die trying to protect it. Worse than those who want to collect gorillas for their private zoos are those who just want to collect bits of gorillas. For many years there was a brisk trade in skulls and hands which were sold to tourists and expatriates who mistakenly thought that they would look finer on their mantelpieces than they did on the original gorilla. This, thank goodness, is also now declining since a taste for bone-headed brutality is now held to be less of a social grace than formerly. In some parts of Africa, gorillas are still killed for food, though not in the Virunga volcanoes, at least not deliberately. The problem is that many other animals are, and gorillas very frequently get caught in traps set for bushbuck or duiker. A young female gorilla called Josie, for example, caught her hand in a wire antelope snare and eventually died of septicemia in August 1988. So, to protect the gorillas, anti-poaching patrols are still necessary. There were 2 other people sharing our hut that night. They were a couple of German students whose name I appear now to have forgotten, but since they were indistinguishable from all other German students we had encountered from time to time on our trips, I will simply call them Helmut and Kurt. Helmut and Kurt were young, fair-haired, vigorous, and incredibly well-equipped, and much better than us at virtually everything. We saw very little of them during the early part of the evening, because they were very busy preparing their meal. This involved constructing some kind of brick oven outside, and then doing a lot of coming and going with bowls of boiling water, stopwatches, penknives, and dismembered bits of the local wildlife. Eventually, they sat and ate their feast in front of us with grim efficiency, and an insulting refusal to make any disparaging glances at all in the direction of our tinned pear halves. Then they said they were going to bed for the night, only they weren't going to sleep in the hut because they had a tent with them, which was much better. It was a German tent. They nodded us a curt good night and left. In bed that night, after I had lain awake for a while, worrying about Marara and Serendori's casual propensity for shooting people, I turned to worrying instead about Helmut and Kurt. If they were going to be like that, then I just wished they hadn't actually been German. It was too easy, too obvious. It was like coming across an Irishman who actually was stupid, a mother-in-law who actually was fat, or an American businessman who actually did have a middle initial and smoke a cigar. You feel as if you are unwillingly performing in a music hall sketch and wishing you could rewrite the script. If Helmut and Kurt had been Brazilian or Chinese or Latvian or anything else at all, they could have behaved in exactly the same way, and it would have been surprising and intriguing, and, more to the point from my perspective, much easier to write about. Writers should not be in the business of propping up stereotypes. I wondered what to do about it. Decided that they could simply be Latvians if I wanted, and then at last drifted off peacefully to worrying about my boots. Mark had told me before we went to bed that when I woke up, the first thing I had to remember was to turn my boots upside down and shake them. I asked him why. "Scorpions," he said. "Good night." Early in the morning, Marara and Serendori were waiting at the hut door, fondling their rifles and machetes and wearing meaningful glints in their eyes that we weren't at all certain we liked. However, they had good news for us. Since gorillas tend not to make their personal arrangements to suit the convenience of visiting collateral relatives, they were sometimes to be found up to 8 hours' trek away from the visitor's hut. Today, however, the news was that they were only about an hour's distance from us, so we would have an easy day of it. We gathered together our gorilla watching gear, carefully leaving behind the aftershave, the Dickens, and also our flash guns, on the assumption that these were all things that would, to differing degrees, upset the gorillas. Said good morning to Helmut and Kurt, who were joining us for the expedition, and set off together in search of the gorillas. Ahead of us, through the misty morning light, reared the hump of Mikano Volcano. The forest we plunged into was thick and wet, and I complained about this to Mark. He explained that gorillas like to live in montane rainforest, or cloud forest. It was over 3,000 metres above sea level, above the cloud level, and always damp. Water drips off the trees the whole time. "It's not at all like lowland primary rainforest," said Mark. "More like secondary rainforest, which is what you get when primary rainforest is burnt or cut down and then starts to regenerate." "Huh. I thought the whole problem with rainforest was that it wouldn't grow again when you cut it down," I said. "You won't get primary rainforest again, of course," said Mark. "Well, you might get something similar over hundreds of thousands of years. We don't know. Certainly all of the original wildlife will have been lost for good. But what grows in the short term is secondary rainforest, which is far less rich and complex. Primary rainforest is an incredibly complex system. But when you're actually standing in it, it looks half empty. In its mature state, you get a very high, thick canopy of leaves because of all the trees competing with each other to get at the sunlight. But since little light penetrates this canopy, there will tend to be very little vegetation at ground level. Instead, you get an ecological system which is the most complex of any on Earth, and it's all designed to disseminate the energy which the trees have absorbed from the sun throughout the whole forest. Cloud forest like this is much simpler. The trees are much lower and more spaced out, so there's plenty of ground cover vegetation as well, all of which the gorillas like very much because it means they can hide. And there's plenty of food within arm's reach. For us, however, all the thick, wet vegetation made the forest hard work to fight through. Marara and Serendori swung their machetes so casually through the almost impenetrable undergrowth that it took me a while to begin to see that there was more to it than just vague hacking. Machetes are a very specific shape, a little like the silhouette of a banana with a fattened end. Every part of the blade has a slightly different curve or angle of cut to the line of movement, and a different weight behind it as well. It was fascinating to watch the instinctive ways in which, from one slash to another, the guides would adapt their stroke to the exact type of vegetation they were trying to cut through. One moment it would be a thick branch, another moment it would be banks of nettles, another moment tangled hanging vines. It was like a very casual game of tennis played by highly skilled players. Not only was the forest thick, it was also cold, wet, and full of large black ants, which bit all of us except for Helmut and Kurt, who were wearing special ant-proof socks, which they had brought with them from Latvia. We complimented them on their foresight, and they shrugged and said it was nothing. Latvians are always well prepared. They looked at our recording equipment and said that they were surprised that we thought it was adequate. They had much better tape recorders than that in Latvia. We said that that might very well be so, but that we were very happy with it, and the BBC seemed to think it was fine for the job. Helmut, or was it Kurt, explained that they had much better broadcasting corporations in Latvia. The outbreak of outright hostilities was happily averted at this moment by a signal from our guides to keep quiet. We were near the guerrillas. "But of course," said Kurt, with a slight smile playing along his thin Latvian lips, as if he'd known all the while that this is exactly where the guerrillas would be. But it wasn't a gorilla itself that had attracted our guide's attention. It was a gorilla's bed. By the side of the track along which we were walking, there was a large depression in the undergrowth where a gorilla had been sleeping for the night. Plant stems had been pulled down and folded under to keep the gorilla off the ground, which was cold and damp at night. One of the characteristics that laymen find most odd about zoologists is their insatiable enthusiasm for animal droppings. I can understand, of course, that the droppings yield a great deal of information about the habits and diets of the animals concerned, but nothing quite explains the sheer glee that the actual objects seem to inspire. A sharp yelp of joy told me that Mark had found some. He dropped to his knees and started to fire off his Nikon at a small pile of gorilla dung. "It's in the nest," he explained once he had finished, "which is very interesting, you see. The mountain gorillas, the ones that live here, actually defecate in their nests because it's too cold to get up at night. The western lowland gorillas, on the other hand, don't. They live in a warmer climate, so getting up in the middle of the night is less of a problem. Also, the western lowland gorillas live on a diet of fruit, which is another incentive for not shitting in their nests." "I see," I said. Helmut started to say something, which I like to think was probably something about having far superior types of gorilla dung in Latvia, but I interrupted him because I suddenly had one of those strange, uncanny feelings that I was being watched by a truck. We kept very quiet and looked very carefully around us. There was nothing we could see near us, nothing in the trees above us, nothing peering furtively from the bushes. It was a moment or two before we saw anything at all, but then at last a slight movement caught our eyes. About 30 yards away down the track we were following, standing in plain view, was something so big that we hadn't even noticed it. It was a mountain gorilla. Or perhaps I should say a gorilla mountain, standing propped up on its front knuckles so that it assumed the shape of a large and muscular sloping ridge tent. You will have heard it said before that these creatures are awesome beasts, and I would like to add my own particular perception to this. These creatures are awesome beasts. It is hard to know how better to put it. A kind of humming mental paralysis grips you when you first encounter a creature such as this in the wild, and indeed there is no creature such as this. All sorts of wild and vertiginous feelings well up into your brain that you seem to have no connection with and no name for, perhaps because it is thousands or millions of years since such feelings were last aroused. I'm going to be a bit fanciful for a moment, because it's very hard not to be when your rational, civilized brain, I use the words in the loosest possible sense, experiences things it has no way of recognizing or accounting for, but which are nevertheless very powerful. I've heard an idea proposed, I've no idea how seriously, to account for the sensation of vertigo. It's an idea that I instinctively like, and it goes like this. The dizzy sensation we experience when standing in high places is not simply a fear of falling. It's often the case that the only thing likely to make us fall is the actual dizziness itself, so it is at best an extremely irrational, even self-fulfilling fear. However, in the distant past of our evolutionary journey towards our current state, we lived in trees. We leapt from tree to tree. There are even those who speculate that we may have something bird-like in our ancestral line, in which case there may be some part of our mind that, when confronted with the void, expects to be able to leap out into it, and even urges us to do so. So what you end up with is a conflict between a primitive, atavistic part of our mind, which is saying, jump! And the more modern, rational part of your mind, which is saying, for Christ's sake, don't! Certainly, the dizzy experience of vertigo seems to have far more in common with feelings of oscillating mental conflict and confusion than it does with simple fear. If it's a fear, it's one we love to play with and tease ourselves with, which is how designers of Big Dippers and Ferris wheels make a living. The feeling I had looking at my first silverback gorilla in the wild was vertiginous. It was as if there was something I was meant to do, some reaction that was expected of me, and I didn't know what it was or how to do it. My modern mind was simply saying, run away, but all I could do was stand, trembling, and stare. The right moment for something seemed to slip away and fall into an unbridgeable gulf between us and the gorilla, and left us simply gawping helplessly on our side. The gorilla, meanwhile, seemed to notice that we had been busy photographing its dung and merely stalked off into the undergrowth. We set off to follow it, but it was in its own element and we were not. We were not even able to tell whereabouts in its own element it was, and after a while we gave up and started to explore the area more generally again. The gorilla we had seen was a large male silverback. Silverback simply means that its back was silver, or grey-haired. Only the backs of males turn silver, and it happens after the male has reached maturity. Tradition has it that only the chief male of a group will develop a silver back, and that it will happen within days or even hours of it taking over as leader. But this apparently is nonsense. Popular and beguiling nonsense, but nonsense. And while we are on the subject of nonsense, I should mention something we discovered a few days later when talking to Conrad Aveling, a field researcher in Goma, who has for years been responsible for gorilla conservation work in the area. We told Conrad how alarmed we had been by Morara and Serendora's accounts of simply going out and mowing down the local poachers, and he sat back in his chair, kicked up his heels, and roared with laughter. It's incredible what these guys will tell the tourists. I bet they told you they were ex-commandos as well, did they? We admitted, rather sheepishly, that they had. Conrad clasped his hand to his brow and shook his head. The only thing about them that's ex-commando, he said, is their uniforms. They buy them off the commandos. The commandos sell them to buy food because they hardly ever get paid. It's all complete nonsense. I heard another great story the other day. A tourist had asked a guide, and this was at Rawindi, where there are no gorillas. The tourist asked, what happens when a gorilla meets a lion? And instead of answering, well, that's a silly question, because lions and gorillas live in completely different areas and would never meet, the guide obviously feels obliged to think of some sort of colourful answer. So he says, what happens is that the gorilla beats the hell out of the lion, then wraps his body in leaves and twigs, and then stamps on him. I only heard about it myself because the tourist came to me afterwards and said how fascinated he'd been to hear about it. It bothers me when they make up these colourful answers. I wish I could make them understand that if they don't know the answer, or they think the right answer isn't very interesting, it's better to say so rather than just invent absolute nonsense. One thing that was beyond dispute, however, was that when our guides were not inventing stuff or acting out Rambo fantasies, they really knew the forest, and they really knew the gorillas. They had, and Conrad Aveling confirmed this enthusiastically, themselves habituated two of the gorilla groups for human contact. Habituating is a very long, complicated, and delicate business, but briefly, it is the process of contacting a group in the wild and visiting them every day, if you can find them, over a period of months or even years, and training them to accept the presence of human beings, so that they can then be studied and also visited by tourists. The length of time it takes to habituate gorillas depends on the dominant silverback. He's the one whose confidence you have to win. In the case of the family group we were visiting, it took fully 3 years. Conrad Aveling spent the first 8 months of his time on the project crawling around in the undergrowth with them, but never actually saw them once, though he was often no more than 20 or 30 feet away. One of the problems of habituating in this sort of habitat, he explained, is that it's so thick you can't see each other, and what happens is you end up having these sudden confrontations at about 3 or 4 metres or less, and you still can't see each other. Everybody's jumping out of their skin, the gorilla's jumping out of his skin, I'm jumping out of mine. It's extremely exciting, and you get a real adrenaline rush. A problem with the Bukavu group was that the silverback wouldn't charge. I actually wanted him to, because then, having charged, he would expose himself and then realise that I didn't mean him any harm. But he wouldn't do that, he just kept circling. Usually they do charge, and if they do, you have this face-to-face, and you have a moment to understand that neither of you means the other any harm, and the gorilla backs off. But you go into a submissive posture, do you? Asked Mark. You don't confront him. No, I usually don't go into a submissive posture. I'm usually too frightened to move. Once a silverback accepts humans, the rest of the group will quickly fall into line, and, interestingly enough, any other groups in the area will usually become habituated much more quickly. There's hardly ever any trouble, provided everybody treats everybody else with respect. The gorillas are perfectly capable of making it clear when they don't wish to be disturbed. There was one occasion on which a gorilla group had had a particularly stressful morning as a result of an encounter with another gorilla group, and the last thing they wanted was to be bothered with humans in the afternoon. So when a tracker brought some tourists and overstayed his welcome, the silverback took hold of the tracker's hand and gently bit his watch off. Now, the business of tourism is obviously a vexed one. I had myself wanted to visit the gorillas for years, but had been deterred by the worry that tourism must be disturbing to the gorillas' habitat and way of life. There is also the risk of exposing the gorillas to diseases to which they have no immunity. It is well known that the famous and extraordinary pioneer of gorilla conservation, Diane Fossey, was for most of her life passionately opposed to tourism and wished to keep the world away from the gorillas. However, she did, reluctantly, change her mind towards the end of her life, and the prevalent view now is that tourism, if it's carefully controlled and monitored, is the one thing that can guarantee the gorilla's future survival. The sad but unavoidable fact is that it comes down to simple economics. Without tourists, it's only a question of which will happen first. Either the gorilla's forest habitat will be entirely destroyed for crop farming and firewood, or the gorillas will be hunted to extinction by poachers. Put at its crudest, the gorillas are now worth more to the locals and the government alive than dead. The restrictions, which are tightly enforced, are these. Each gorilla family can only be visited once a day, usually for about an hour, by a party of a maximum of 6 people, each of whom are paying $100 for the privilege. And maybe they won't even get to see the gorillas. We were lucky. We did. Though after our first brief encounter with the silverback, it looked for a while as if we would not find any more. We moved slowly and carefully through the undergrowth, while Murara and Serendori made regular coughing and grunting noises. The purpose of these was to let the gorillas know we were coming and reassure them that we meant no harm. The noises are imitations of a noise that gorillas themselves make. Apparently it doesn't actually matter much about trying to imitate them, though. It's hardly going to fool anyone. It just reassures the gorillas that you always make the same noise. You could sing the national anthem as far as they're concerned. Just as we were about to give up and go back, we tried one more turning, and suddenly the forest seemed to be thick with gorillas. A few feet above us, a female was lounging in a tree, idly stripping the bark off a twig with her teeth. She'd noticed us, but was not interested. 2 babies were cavorting recklessly 4 metres from the ground in a very slender tree, and a young male was chugging through the undergrowth nearby on the lookout for food. We stared at the 2 babies in astounded fascination, at the wonderful wild abandon with which they were hurling themselves round each other, and the terrible meagreness of the tree in which they had elected to do it. It was hard to believe the tree could support them, and indeed it couldn't. They suddenly came crashing down through it, having completely misunderstood the law of gravity, and slunk off sheepishly into the undergrowth. We followed, encountering one gorilla after another, until at last we came across another silverback, lying on his side beneath a bush, with his long arm folded up over his head, scratching his opposite ear, while he watched a couple of leaves doing not very much. It was instantly clear what he was doing. He was mooching, It was quite obvious. Or rather, the temptation to find it quite obvious was absolutely overwhelming. They look like humans, they move like humans, they hold things in their fingers like humans. The expressions which play across their faces and in their intensely human-looking eyes are expressions which we instinctively feel we recognise as human expressions. We look them in the face and we think we know what they're like. But we don't. Or rather, we actually block off any possible glimmering of understanding of what they may be like by making easy and tempting assumptions. I crept closer to the silverback, slowly and quietly on my hands and knees, till I was about 18 inches away from him. He glanced round at me unconcernedly, as if I was just someone who'd walked into the room, and continued his contemplations. I guessed that the animal was probably about the same height as me, almost 2 metres, but I would think about twice as heavy. Mostly muscle, with soft, grey-black skin hanging quite loosely on his front, covered in coarse black hair. As I moved again, he shifted himself away from me, just about 6 inches, as if I had sat slightly too close to him on a sofa, and he was grumpily making a bit more room. Then he lay on his front with his chin on his fist, idly scratching his cheek with his other hand. I sat as quiet and still as I could, despite discovering that I was being bitten to death by ants. He looked from one to another of us without any great concern, and then his attention dropped to his own hands as he idly scratched some flecks of dirt off one of his fingers with his thumb. I had the impression that we were of as much interest to him as a boring Sunday afternoon in front of the television. He yawned. "It's so bloody hard not to anthropomorphize, but these impressions keep on crowding in on you because they spark so much instant recognition, however illusory that recognition may be. It's the only way of conveying what it was like." After a quiet interval had passed, I carefully pulled the pink writing paper out of my bag and started to make the notes that I'm working from at the moment. This seemed to interest him a little more. I suppose he'd simply never seen pink writing paper before. His eyes followed as my hand squiggled across the paper, and after a while he reached out and touched first the paper and then the top of my ballpoint pen, not to take it away from me or even to interrupt me, just to see what it was like and what it felt like. I felt very moved by this and had a foolish impulse to want to show him my camera as well. He retreated a little and lay down again about 4 feet from me, with his fist once more propped under his chin. I loved the extraordinary thoughtfulness of his expression and the way his lips were bunched together by the upward pressure of his fist. The most disconcerting intelligence seemed to be apparent from the sudden sidelong glances he would give me, prompted not by any particular move I had made, but apparently by a thought that had struck him. I began to feel how patronizing it was of us to presume to judge their intelligence, as if ours was any kind of standard by which to measure. I tried to imagine instead how he saw us, but of course that's almost impossible to do, because the assumptions you end up making as you try to bridge the imaginative gap are, of course, your own, and the most misleading assumptions are the ones you don't even know you're making. I pictured him lying there easily in his own world, tolerating my presence in it, but, I think, possibly sending me signals to which I did not know how to respond. And then I pictured myself beside him, festooned with the apparatus of my intelligence, my Gore-Tex cagoule, my pen and paper, my autofocus matrix metering Nikon F4, and my inability to comprehend any of the life we had left behind us in the forest. But somewhere in the genetic history that we each carry with us in every cell of our body was a deep connection with this creature, as inaccessible to us now as last year's dreams, but like last year's dreams, always invisibly and unfathomably present. It put me in mind of what I think must be a vague memory of a movie in which a New Yorker, the son of Eastern European immigrants, goes to find the village that his family originally came from. He is rich and successful, and expects to be greeted with excitement, admiration, and wonder. Instead, he is not exactly rejected, not exactly dismissed, but is welcomed in ways which he is unable to understand. He is disturbed by their lack of reaction to his presence, until he realizes that their stillness in the face of him is not rejection, but merely a peace that he is welcome to join, but not to disturb. The gifts he has brought with him from civilization turn to dust in his hands, as he realizes that everything he has is merely the shadow cast by what he has lost. I watched the gorilla's eyes again, wise and knowing eyes, and wondered about this business of trying to teach apes language, our language. Why? There are many members of our own species who live in and with the forest and know it and understand it. We don't listen to them. What is there to suggest we would listen to anything an ape could tell us? Or that it would be able to tell us of its life in a language that wasn't born of that life? I thought, maybe it is not that they have yet to gain a language. It is that we have lost one. The silverback seemed at last to tire of our presence. He hauled himself to his feet and lumbered easily off into another part of his home. On the way back to the hut, I discovered that I had a small tin of tuna in my camera bag, so we greedily devoured this on our return, along with a bottle of beer. And that, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, marked the end of fun for the day. Unless you count listening to a couple of Latvian students explaining how good their penknives are as fun. At this, Mark started to get quietly ratty, which meant that he grasped the beer bottle very tightly between his hands and stared at it a lot. Kurt asked us what we were planning to do next, and we said that we were flying up to Garamba National Park to see if we could find any northern white rhinos. Kurt nodded and said that himself he thought he would probably walk to Uganda tonight. Mark's knuckles grew whiter round his beer bottle. Mark, like most zoologists, tends to prefer animals to people anyway, but in this case I was with him all the way. It occurred to me that we had spent a day rapt with wonder watching the mountain gorillas and being particularly moved at how human they seemed, and finding this to be one of their most engaging and fascinating features. To find afterwards that a couple of hours spent with actual humans was merely irritating was a bit confusing.